Want to learn more about the unknown ladies of architecture? Then I recommend you listen to She Builds Podcast, where we tell the stories of remarkable women who have shaped the design and construction industries.
Hi, I'm Jessica.
I'm Nurjiti.
And I'm Lizzie.
After we graduated from Syracuse University School of Architecture, we set out to learn and share the untold stories of women that traditional school curriculum left out.
One day, there's an announcement on campus that women had been seen wearing, quote, inappropriate clothing. Gasp.
What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, so it turns out that Ruth and her fellow classmates were these women. They had field classes where they're doing welding, forging, and foundry work, and obviously they have to wear jeans to those classes instead of, like, dresses or whatever else.
While Gertie was in school, she wasn't just going to classes, trying to stay alive like some of us. I know that was me in school, just taking it day by day.
Yes.
But not Gertie. She became the president of EVIGOL, an honorary association of Cornell women architects.
Of course she did.
These are stories not taught in schools. Women who've molded the world of architecture, construction, and development for over a century.
From Jane Jacobs to Ray Eames, She Builds Podcast explores the legacies of trailblazers. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
Let's fill the gaps in history together. All you have to do is follow the link in the show notes and subscribe and be part of a movement to expand industry narratives.
Welcome to Tangible Remnants. I'm Nikita Reed, and this is my show where I explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender. I'm excited that you're here. So let's get into it. Welcome back. This week is a solo episode and will be a little different than most, because instead of focusing on one historic building or highlighting a professional who's currently practicing, this episode is going to focus on the various financial tools available to finance the renovation of a historic building. So if you're working on your own tangible remnant or know anyone else working on a historic building that is looking for additional ways to finance it, please send them this episode. I'll cover the various financing products at a very high level, and we'll provide some great resources in the show notes if you're interested in learning more. You can also head over to our Instagram page at Tangible Remnants for some graphics and charts on the various financing options. And one final thing before we get into the financials. If you're enjoying this podcast, I would love for you to leave a review. It helps with the rankings and also would help me reach more folks. If you're not loving the podcast, don't worry about leaving a review. All right, so outside of traditional loans, when it comes to funding renovations, the main categories you'd want to look into include grants or bond bills, tax credits, or rebates and incentives. Also, I need to mention that I am not a CPA, nor do I play one on this podcast. So please make sure to do your due diligence, talk to your attorney and your CPA to find out what is viable for your individual project, jurisdiction, and situation. All right, so grants and bond bills. So various organizations offer grants. Sometimes the grants are just for facade improvements. Sometimes they're for energy upgrades. It just depends on the particular language of the grant. A lot of times, grants for building renovation and those types of projects are called capital projects. So when you're looking for grants, be sure to look for grants that are going towards capital projects, as opposed to non-capital projects or planning projects or something like that. Additionally, most states issue different types of debt. And the most common is a general obligation bond that is paid from the general fund and then backed by the taxing authority of the state. And so for this type of funding, there would need to be political will behind your project, basically. In Maryland, these are referred to as bond bills, and they are filed by a member of the General Assembly to support specific local or non-state-owned capital projects. And so in general, whenever you're doing any type of redevelopment of a building or historic building, it's typically a good idea to meet with your local and state representatives to make them aware of the project you're working on and also to let them know how your renovation or your development will help their constituents. Another thing to be mindful of when thinking about accepting or taking or pursuing a grant or bond bill is that whenever you're taking one of these, you may be required to give the organization an easement on your building, depending upon the conditions of the grant or bond bill. And an easement would mean that the granting organization would have purview over any changes that you want to make to the building for a certain period of time. So I'm not saying easements are a bad thing. I know that they can be very beneficial in certain situations, but I just want to make sure that you understand the constraints before saying yes to accepting anything that seems like free money. The next category is tax credits. And this is a big one. And a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about these. So I wanted to start off by saying that a tax credit reduces the specific amount of tax that an individual owes. So for instance, if you have a $500 tax credit and a $3,500 tax bill, the tax credit would reduce your bill to $3,000. It is not cash up front. It is a credit that you can claim on your taxes. And I will say the caveat with it not being cash up front is that there are some exemptions or there are some exceptions in certain states for certain nonprofits, but that's a different conversation. The three main tax credits that are used for capital projects are historic tax credits, new market tax credits, and low-income housing tax credits. Two of the three of the tax credits can be combined, and it's typically either the historic tax credit with the new market tax credit or the historic credit with the low-income housing tax credit. Typically, the low-income housing tax credit and the new markets tax credits don't mix. So starting with the historic tax credits, there are federal, state, and sometimes local historic tax credits available. The federal historic tax credits can typically apply to 20% of the qualified rehabilitation expenditures, often shorthanded as QREs. And these can cover things like the architecture and engineering fees, construction costs for everything that's inside the footprint of the existing building, including new elevator, new HVAC, all of those types of things. The historic tax credit would not apply to anything outside of the footprint of the building, nor would it apply to things like landscaping, acquisition cost, and a number of other things. In the show notes, I'll put a link to a tax credit guide that'll give you more detailed information about this one. So in addition to the federal historic tax credit, many states also have their own state historic tax credit. And in most instances, you can get another 20% from the state. So if you're going after state and federal historic tax credits, you could potentially get up to 40% of your project cost supported with historic tax credits. Tax credits are typically utilized by private developers and nonprofits through syndication. And to be eligible to receive the historic tax credit, the building must be listed on the National Register, must be income producing, and spend more than the basis. When submitting the historic tax credit, there are three parts to the application. Parts one and two are typically submitted around the end of the design development process. And then part three is submitted after the construction on the building is complete. Throughout the process, you want to be talking to your SHPO, your State Historic Preservation Office, and make sure that the design is in line with the Secretary of the Interior standards and all of that good stuff. And so as a reminder, though, historic tax credits are just that, a credit on your taxes, not cash up front. So the historic tax credit is claimed over a five-year period. So you do 20% every year after the building is placed in service. So you would begin claiming the credit when you go to do the taxes of the year that the building was placed in service. So for instance, if you finish construction in 2024 and place the building in service or started occupying the building, then you would claim the historic tax credit in 2025 when you did your taxes for the year of 2024. One thing to be mindful of with the historic tax credit is that there is a period of 5 years after the building is placed in service where any changes or alterations have to be approved by the State Historic Preservation Office or the SHPO. Otherwise, you risk losing portions of the tax credit through recapture. I'm doing my best not to get too deep into the woods on this episode, but historic tax credits are one of my favorite things to talk about. So I'll make sure to put a link in the show notes to the historic tax credit guide that Quinn Evans just produced. I was excited to be one of the people to help put that together for the refresh of it. So it has much more information that will be helpful for you. I know I mentioned a little bit that nonprofits can potentially use the historic tax credit. And you may be thinking, well, how can a nonprofit use a tax credit if they don't have a tax liability? Well, tax credits, certain tax credits, can be syndicated. And it's a somewhat convoluted process that requires additional LLCs to be set up. But the gist is that if you're looking to redevelop a building, but you don't have enough tax liability to claim the credit, then you can partner with someone who does have the tax liability to claim the credit. And what they would essentially do is provide equity cash upfront into the project in exchange for being able to have the rights to claim the historic tax credit once the project was complete. So typically, equity is often provided at 75 cents to 80 cents on the dollar of the historic tax credit, and it would provide the additional needed capital to complete the work. A lot of times, investors are interested in pursuing historic tax credits because it's often better returns and better terms than what they would get through a traditional loan. And so one of the nice things about historic tax credits, particularly in Maryland, is that if you are doing a sustainable renovation and your project is pursuing LEED Gold certification or something comparable, then you can get an extra 5% in your state tax credit. So instead of getting 20% of your QREs, you'd be able to get 25% if you actually pursued LEED Gold certification or higher. And for those of you who may be wondering, well, how many people are actually using historic tax credits? Is this even something that's viable or well known? Well, in the fiscal year of 2022, just that year alone, the federal historic tax credit program received over 1,000 proposed project applications. More than 850 projects were completed, which amounted to a certified amount of about $6.5 billion in rehabilitation work. And yes, that was billion with a B. The program also helped make possible an additional 9,000 housing units in buildings that were converted to a residential use. So yeah, the historic tax credits are definitely a viable product that many developers are pursuing.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good, and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.
I've mentioned it to my family, but in terms of telling people like, oh yeah, we're doing this, I'm looking for projects, you got anything? Yeah. I'm not there yet because it scares the shit out of me.
Dreaming of launching your own architecture firm? Well, buckle up for a wild ride with Emerging, the podcast that shares what it's really like to start an architecture firm.
Where do we begin? We don't even know what type of business to formalize as. Is it an LLC? Is it an LLP? Like, how are taxes? I mean, the list is astronomical.
Season one featured founders Jeffrey, Lexi, and Chris, owners of Level Studio Architecture, are your fearless guides on this unfiltered journey from napkin sketches to a thriving studio.
One evening, stumbled into one last dive, we sat at the bar and pondered our postgraduate futures. Amidst the conversation, a napkin became the canvas for our aspirations, sketching plans and milestones, sealing our heartfelt commitment and shared dreams.
In drawing down dreams on a napkin collectively, that then, you know, in your head, you've rooted like, oh, I'm connected to these people, like long term.
The process of starting an architecture practice brims with excitement and challenges, demanding meticulous planning, flawless execution, and unyielding resilience.
I kind of hate the term because it's so overly used, but I think everybody knows imposter syndrome. And I think it's so real to this day. I don't know if it's with everybody, but with me, I'm always questioning, like, us, can we do this? Are we ready to do this? Are we prepared? Can we do it?
Did we just decide a name?
We did it, guys.
Oh my
one that
God.
Came out of nowhere.
Woo!
It came out of nowhere. I liked it. I saw it.
Ready to turn your aspirations into reality? Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Emerging and chart your own path to architectural success.
So in addition to the historic tax credits, there are new market tax credits and low-income housing tax credits. The new market program attracts private capital into low-income communities by permitting individuals and corporate investors to receive a tax credit against their federal income tax. To receive a tax credit against their federal income in exchange for making equity investments in specialized financial intermediaries called community development entities, or CDEs. And so the new market tax credit totals 39% of the original investment amount and is claimed over a period of 7 years. And so the third and final tax credit that I'll talk about is the low-income housing tax credit, which is often abbreviated to LIHTC, and it's often pronounced LIHTC for shorthand. And this program is the most important resource for creating affordable housing in the United States. It was created by the Tax Reform Act of 1986, just like the other programs, and it gives state and local LIHTC allocating agencies the equivalent of approximately $9 billion in annual budget authority to issue tax credits for the acquisition, rehabilitation, or new construction of rental housing targeted to lower income households. So the LIHTC program is designed to subsidize either 30% or 70% of the low-income unit cost in a project. The 30% subsidy is often known as the 4% LIHTC tax credit, and that covers new construction and uses additional subsidies for the acquisition of existing buildings. And then the 70% tax credit is often known as the 9% credit. Regardless of which tax credit you're interested in pursuing, it's super important to work with a CPA that's familiar with how these programs work. And one of the other things which I found super interesting when I was getting into this work is to find out that there are actually tax credit brokers and matchmakers who will help qualified projects that need money connect with investors looking for ways to invest in tax credit projects. And regardless of which tax credit you want to pursue, just be sure to double check the eligibility requirements for the programs, the percentage of the tax credit available, and then any sort of deadlines and things like that that you have to be mindful of. All right, moving on to category number 3. And this is the last one we'll talk about today. And this one is rebates and incentives. And so after tax credits, my next go-to recommendation for clients who are looking for funding is the Desire website. But you got to be careful how you search for it because it's not spelled like the emotion. It's actually spelled D-S-I-R-E. And stands for the Database of State Incentives for Renewables and Efficiency. And this website allows you to search by state and includes a number of different sources. And the types of incentives vary from a rebate program to an access policy or a grant program. This website has been around for many years and is updated sporadically, so you may have to verify if the programs are still active, but it's often a good resource to be able to see what could be available from different state agencies and other organizations around the country. A more recent piece of legislation that is having a big impact and is a game changer for many projects is the Inflation Reduction Act. And it's estimated that this incentive payout is going to pass the $1 trillion mark, with a trillion with a T. I put a link in the show notes to a great webinar by Casey Ross at the Lorax Partnership that walks through the various rebates available for buildings through the Inflation Reduction Act. And then there are a couple other blog posts and some calculators and incentives that I'll put in the show notes as well. So you can really check out what's available. Because at first blush, when you hear Inflation Reduction Act, you may think, oh, that has nothing to do with renovating buildings. But it absolutely does, particularly for all of the energy incentives and rebates that are included in the legislation. So there are also nonprofits like New Ecology who can provide additional insight into various grants that are available. All right, well, that's all the financial goodness I have for you this week. I hope it helps out anyone who's working on their own tangible remnant. Are there other programs that you typically use or that you're interested in learning more about? If so, you can email me at tangiblerumnants@gmail.com or comment under this episode on Instagram or LinkedIn.
Thank you so much for listening. Links to amazing resources can be found in the episode's show notes. Special thanks to Sarah Gilberg for allowing me to use snippets of her song Fireflies from her debut album, Other People's Secrets, which, by the way, is available wherever music is sold. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show. And now that Tangible Remnants is part of the Gable Media Network, you can listen and subscribe to all network partner content at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. Until next time, remember that historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling our inclusive history.
I saw the first fireflies of summer, and right then I thought of you. Oh, I could see us catching them and setting them free. Honey, that's what you do. That's what you do to me.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick. So when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns. What's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.